We might just think we're hearing a poem from a young fellow falling head over heels in love for the first time. He begins, "This poem was written to and for the one I love, the girl in which all my dreams are made of, the one who has truly filled that empty space in my life, and the one who is soon to be my future wife. When I look into your eyes, I see a glance of hope, reassurance that you're the one for me and the one with whom I'll elope. If someone were to ask me, how much do you love her? More than words can express would surely be my answer. God answered my prayers that night I wished upon a star, and it was definitely the best dream come true by far. The night I asked and wished for someone to fill that hole, you came just in the nick of time and captured my soul. I love you with my whole heart and definitely always will. A kiss from you is such an unexplainable thrill. Until the day I die, my heart will eternally be yours. For every other girl, I've already closed the doors. I truly love you, Emily, and forever you'll be mine, forever and always, until the end of time." Words of Taylor Hooton from his poem, Emily, from July 14th, 2003. We're told Taylor was at heart a romantic who could express his feelings in a creative and articulate manner. What distinguishes the poem, though, is the passion that informs it. His professed love for Parker is so strong that he views it as the result of God having, quote, answered his prayers, a love that fills the center of his heart, making him feel whole. On the other hand, Taylor's admission of a personal dependency on Parker is dangerous at a time when he was struggling to find emotional and mental stability in his life. His seemingly confident assumption that he would eventually marry Parker contradicts the insecurity he expresses over the possibility of a breakup with her, something that he says would result in his heart being ripped apart. Taylor also rules out any alternative for a meaningful relationship with another female, as he reveals in the line, "For every other girl, I've already closed the doors." What is so troubling is the contradiction in the final stanza of the poem, which begins, "Until the day I die, my heart will eternally be yours." To be sure, there is no limit to eternal love. It goes beyond the grave, or, as Taylor writes in the last line of the stanza, "Forever and always, until the end of time." It begs this question, is Taylor's assurance of eternal love for Parker a veiled message that he plans to take his life? It was one day after writing this poem, July 15th, 2003, that Taylor Hooton hanged himself from his bedroom door. All this from a recent book by William Cachetis titled Suicide Squeeze, Taylor Hooton, Rob Garibaldi, and the Fight Against Teenage Steroid Abuse, just issued by Temple University Press. The study is described as a chronicle of the experiences of two promising high school baseball players who abused appearance and performance-enhancing drugs in hopes of attracting professional scouts and Division I recruiters. Two young players who, as a result of their steroid abuse, ended up taking their own lives. Dr. Cachetis is an historian, educator, and amateur baseball coach. He is a regular contributor to the Philadelphia Inquirer and newspapers here in northeastern Pennsylvania. He is the author of several books on baseball, including Jackie and Campy, The Untold Story of Their Rocky Relationship, and The Breaking of Baseball's Color Line. Dr. Cachetis is on the faculty at Luzerne County Community College, and he returned to the WVIA studios to tell this story, which he feels so very strongly about, set as it is against the backdrop of a realm of life he is passionate about as well. We began by talking about the way he has come to understand baseball and his own ties to the game.
I think most people, when they see a baseball game for the very first time, they either get it or they don't. There's really no in between. And what I mean by that is you fall in love with the game immediately, and it's a combination of the atmosphere and the game itself. It is a thinking person's game. There is not constant action on the field, so you're always anticipating what is going to happen. I mean, if you were to reduce the action in a baseball game to time, you're probably talking about 20 minutes total. And a lot of people, as Americans, don't like that type of thing. So you either get it or you don't. Even from a child, I tended to be a very reflective person, and that appealed to me. The other thing that appealed to me is that there is a passion in our family for baseball. My grandfather played in the Anthracite Leagues, and that love had been passed down to me. In fact, when I used to sit in his tavern in Glen Lyon, there was a baseball game on all the time, and I was a catcher. So if there was a first and third situation, runners on first and third, he'd come in and he'd quiz me. What are you going to do if the runner from first breaks for second? So we always had this ongoing relationship, and some of the fondest memories I had of my childhood was my time with my grandfather around baseball. And it was a very innocent time. I mean, baseball's a child's game. And what has made me so disillusioned is how the major leagues have corrupted amateur baseball. I really think that the steroid issue worked its way down from major league baseball into the minor leagues, and then into college baseball, the junior colleges, and then into the high schools. I mean, there is that ripple effect, and you can understand it. I mean, if a major leaguer is an average player, he's going to do whatever he can to stay in the major leagues and make that kind of money. So why wouldn't a kid who wants to make the pros take the same stuff that a major league player is doing?
Remind us what the ideals used to be when you were coaching and when people you respected were coaching. What was it that we were trying to instill in young people?
Well, I grew up in the late 60s and the 1970s, and I don't want to be misleading. Major League Baseball had drug problems at that period of time, too. The drug was cocaine back at that period of time. However, at the amateur level, it was much more innocent. And particularly in the Little League stages and in junior high school, and I remember even in my first years of high school, because I played mostly prep school ball, and then I did play a couple years of Legion, but all these coaches, they were teacher coaches, and they saw the value of life lessons on the ball diamond. And baseball is such a wonderful sport for that, because it's a sport predicated on failure. I mean, if the best hitters only reach base 3 times out of every 10 times at bat, and that's a 300 hitter, that's a sport based on failure. So what does baseball teach us? Baseball teaches us that most people fail in life, and what really matters is how you pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and proceed, move on with your life. And that is one of the most valuable lessons that I got from baseball, in addition to sportsmanship and teamwork and perseverance. So baseball was really used as a vehicle for teaching these life lessons. And at least my coaches used it that way. And I think many coaches did in the late 60s and the 70s.
What startled you enough to say, I'm going to look into Taylor's story, I'm going to look into Rob's story, because this is just the tip of the iceberg?
Well, let me take a step back. I'm a historian, and the books I've written up to this period of time deal with 19th century history, usually social justice movements, and baseball. I'm very passionate about baseball, and very passionate about the game and where amateur baseball in particular is heading. So to write Suicide Squeeze for me was a step away from my comfort zone. And it took me 3 full years to write, and I actually was approached on this. Don Hooton, who was the father of Taylor Hooton, and is now the president and CEO of the Taylor Hooton Foundation, which goes around the country and educates parents, teachers, coaches about the symptoms and dangers of anabolic steroid abuse. Don called the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he asked the people at the Hall of Fame if they knew a writer who had experience with amateur baseball and preferably someone who was also a teacher. And they gave Don my name. So he got in touch with me and we talked about the possibility of writing a book. And I thought about it and initially I said no, because it was too heavy a topic for me and I just couldn't see myself doing it. But then I did a lot of reading into the topic, and at this period of time it was also the end of my middle son's teenage tournament career. And I saw these young men who, you know, their physique was just inexplicable to me, unless of course you find out they're taking steroids. So I agreed to it. And although the book is focused on baseball because that was Taylor's favorite sport, and the other young man, Rob Garibaldi, it was also his favorite sport, we have kids that go across the spectrum of all different types of sports who are juicing. And track and football are among the biggest offenders. At any rate, I spent a lot of time with Don and Gwen Hooten, Taylor's parents, and I spent a lot of phone time with the Garibaldis. They're from California, and their son was a highly exceptional baseball player. He was the starting right fielder for the USC Trojans in the 2000 World Series and helped lead them there. He was one of the top 100 prospects, one of Baseball America's top 100 college prospects, and the steroids actually affected him over a period of 3 years. With Taylor, it was quicker. It was a matter of a little over 6 months. And the reason for this is we're talking about adolescence here. There are a lot of physiological and psychological changes that are going on with these kids. And whereas a 23, 4, 5-year-old is basically developed, and if they take steroids, yes, there are going to be effects, but they're not going to have as severe psychological and physiological effects as they will with an adolescent. So in a nutshell, what happened to these two young men is they would take a cycle of 6 weeks of a particular steroid, and then they were supposed to cycle off or not cycle for the same amount of time, but they wanted to get stronger quicker. So at first, they cycled for 6 weeks, and they went off for 3. And then they didn't even take a break. And they started doing what is called stacking, which is mixing steroids, two different types of steroids. And what was happening to them was that they were experiencing all the symptoms, roid rage, or flying off into this violent behavior, severe depression, particularly when they tried to cycle off. And the depression became so severe that thoughts of suicide started to grip them. And as I said, with Taylor, this whole process took a little over 6 months from the time he started cycling decadorablin to the time he fastened together a few of his dress belts, slung it over the door, and hung himself. And with Rob, it took a little over 3 years, and he took a gun to his head and committed suicide. So very tragic stories, and I really admire tremendously the parents, because they were having to go through this again, because Taylor died in July of 2003 and Rob died in October of 2002. So we're talking about a decade or more, and the pain is still raw. It never leaves you. And I will admit that I began to project here thinking, well, what if my son succumbed to this kind of pressure? How could I rebuild my life if he committed suicide? So it was an extremely emotional experience for me, kind of writing I'd never done before. And I literally remember writing this manuscript and sitting in front of my word processor with the tears streaming down my eyes. Because if you can't feel for these parents, you're simply not human.
And you give us a sense of these lads. For example, you include the poetry to give us a sense of the heart and the innocence that was there and was destroyed. And you're not wearing rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember that these two young men were not part of a sordid drug culture. They were not part of decadent lifestyle. They weren't thrill-seeking recreational drug users. Taylor was carrying a 3.8 average in school, high SAT grades, wonderful personality, very courteous. Rob, again, very polite young man, struggled a little bit with attention deficit, but people loved him. He had a lot of friends. And the steroids turned these kids into people who were stealing money, people who lost friends because they exploded into roid rage. Taylor beat the living daylights out of his girlfriend's former boyfriend, and they became delusional. I mean, the steroids completely changed their lives. And these were good kids who were raised by loving middle-class parents. And to see that change was shocking, absolutely shocking. You know, one of the things I really, reasons I wrote this book was to try to prevent another young person from taking their life. And we're, you know, we're talking about 1.5 million adolescents and growing that take anabolic steroids. Now, to give you a better perspective of that number, if you took every Major League Baseball player and every NFL football player who was juicing and gathered them together, the total would not fill the bleachers in a public school football stadium. But if you take that 1.5 million adolescent number and you gather them together, they're going to fill every single Major League Baseball park in this country. And I also should add that that 1.5 million number does not include bisexual or homosexual teens. And they also do not include all those teens that are taking supplements, some of which contain steroid precursors or steroids. I mean, the highest, and this is going to surprise a lot of people, the fastest growing group of teens that are abusing steroids are non-athlete females, and they take it for appearance's sake. This is why we call it APEDs, appearance and performance enhancing drugs.
What about these major league players? What's been the owning up, the taking of responsibility?
Well, first of all, the denial piece is that steroids are not addictive. In fact, they are called a Schedule III classification drug because they supposedly are not addictive. They do have a very clear impact on physiology, but they're Schedule III classification because supposedly they're not addictive or minimally addictive. With teens, they're addictive. And let me tell you, as an athlete, I can tell you that just the act of working out and lifting weights and feeling good, you do that on a regular basis and then you skip a week, psychologically, you're on a low. So maybe the steroids aren't addictive, but that psychological feeling forces you to go back to that routine. Now, how do you build up? You take steroids. So yes, psychologically, it's addictive. And that's what happened with these kids. Now, you ask the question, when did Major League Baseball come to terms with this? They came to terms with it with these two young men, because Bud Selig, who was the commissioner of baseball back in 2005 during the congressional hearings on steroids in Major League Baseball, listened to testimony from the Hootons and the Garibaldis. And he was so taken and upset by this that he promised them that he was going to clean up the game. So Major League Baseball's entire crusade to rid the game is because of these two young men. I think that had their parents not gone before Congress and testified, I think that Major League Baseball players would very happily and merrily go on their way, because the money that's involved in the game is just too much. And we know now, because of the Mitchell Report, which identified many of these Major League Baseball players who were taking steroids, we know now that for years, beginning in the mid-80s, that steroids were the biggest open secret in every Major League clubhouse. Everyone knew what was going on, but no one's going to talk about it. Why? Because there's an unwritten code in baseball. What goes on in the clubhouse stays in the clubhouse. So the whole problem just perpetuated itself.
Tell us about the title and tell us about that play.
Yes, Suicide Squeeze is a play in baseball where there's less than two outs and the offensive team, the team at bat, has a runner on third base. And the coach, the third base coach, will give the batter a sign that he is going to send the runner from third base home on a steal. And it is a fatalistic play, because what happens is if the batter doesn't square around to bunt and make contact with the ball, the catcher's going to catch it and that runner is dead. He's going to be out. However, if the runner manages to score, and usually that occurs when the bunt is successful, then he gets all the glory. And usually this play takes place in a very close game, late in the game, and it can usually spell winning or losing the game. I call it Suicide Squeeze because there are so many similarities to taking steroids for a teenager. Like the runner breaking from the base, they are really wanting all the glory. But in most cases, the squeeze doesn't work, and they're out at home. And this is what has happened, or what happened, to Taylor and Rob. And it's tragic.
You, as an historian, as we know, are concerned about larger trends, putting stories into context, and you do that here. Does this come from larger societal trends, shifts in our mores and our sense of who we are as a people, that then manifests itself within the world of sports?
Absolutely, Erica, absolutely. I hate to say this, but I think we're living in a society that is very sick. I think that the main objective of teachers has always been to cultivate intellectual self-esteem and moral self-esteem among their charges. The responsibility of parents is to cultivate self-esteem, period. And what we're hearing increasingly is that the parent has an attitude of do me proud and I'll love you. If you don't, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And the same message is coming across from the coach. If you're a good athlete, if you're successful, you know, then you're going to get all the playing time and I'm going to look the other way when you do something that's wrong. Well, that's not what sports is supposed to be about, but that's what it has become. In my estimation, at least, that's what it has become. And I do, at the end of the book, give several suggestions on what needs to be done to clean this up. And the very first suggestion is that parents have got to educate themselves about the dangers and the symptoms of steroid use. If they see that their child is exhibiting certain behaviors, like constantly grooming themselves or working out feverishly in a weight room or only playing sports for the reason of improving their looks and their appearance, not for the more intangible values of teamwork and sportsmanship, these are signs that there's something going wrong. And what parents have to do immediately is they should contact the family doctor. They should also contact the coaches at school to see what's going on. But they should also role model a positive image for their kids. And what that means is that they should love their kids unconditionally. Not because, you know, they're a great student or they're a great athlete, but show them that they're cared for and loved simply because of who they are. So I think unless we start taking this problem much more seriously, it's only going to get worse. And it is already a major health care crisis.
Let me just take you to the other side. Are there stories told in film or in fiction, baseball stories, that you go back to?
Well, there's two films that are at the top of my list. I think they're the greatest baseball films that have ever been made. One of them is Field of Dreams, and I don't think a youngster is going to get that. I don't think you get it until you become a father and have a bond, a baseball bond with your child, whether it's a female or a male. But that film, to me, expresses everything that's beautiful about the game, everything that connects generations. And I watch it every Father's Day. And the last scene in which Kevin Costner, who is the farmer Ray Kinsella, has brought back his father. His father has long gone. He has passed on. But he sees his father as a young man. He's brought him back unintentionally. And he sees his father as a young man, as a professional baseball player. And they're out on this field of dreams that Roy has built. And they're having a catch. And I'm sitting there crying. That does it to me. The second one is Peter, my son, and my youngest son, who happens to be autistic, but he also plays baseball. I started a Challenger Baseball League for him, and one of their favorite films is Sandlot, because that film was like my childhood. I mean, what did we do for a pastime? We walked down to the corner of the block, and there was an old Sandlot there, and we just played pickup baseball. And we spent the entire afternoon. Kids don't do that anymore. They let their parents organize everything. And that's a shame. So those are two films that remind me of the innocence of the game and what it should be.
William Cachadas, historian and educator on the faculty of Luzerne County Community College here in northeastern Pennsylvania, speaking with us about his new study, Suicide Squeeze, Taylor Hooten, Rob Garibaldi, and the Fight Against Teenage Steroid Abuse, just issued by Temple University Press. Dr. Cachadas will be at Barnes & Noble at the Arena Hub Plaza in Wilkes-Barre for an author event tomorrow, Saturday, June 10th, at 2 in the afternoon. William C. Cachadas, Saturday, June 10th, tomorrow afternoon at 2, at Barnes & Noble at the Arena Hub Plaza in Wilkes-Barre. Again, 2 o'clock, an author signing tomorrow, Barnes & Noble, William C. Cachadas. For more information, you may check a website for Dr. Cachadas, and that's historylive.net, historylive.net. And for Temple University Press, temple.edu/tempress. TEMPRESS, temple.edu/tempress, or historylive.net. And Cachadas is spelled K-A-S-H-A-T-U-S, K-A-S-H-A-T-U-S, and the book is Suicide Squeeze, Taylor Hooten, Rob Garibaldi, and the Fight Against Teenage Steroid Abuse, just issued by Temple University Press and authored by William C. Cachadas.